The wall breaker stood up and offered Ray Diaz a genial bow. Ray Diaz did not look at him. He took a puff of his cigar and blew out the smoke as he continued to examine it. Fine. Then I'll ask the question that Tyler asked. The wall breaker asked the question for him. If what I say is true, then so what? Ray Diaz stared at the lit end of the cigar and nodded. My answer is the same as Tyler's wall breakers. The Lord does not care. Ray Diaz lifted his eyes from the cigar and looked questioningly at his wall breaker. You look crude, but your mind is sharp. Yet in the depths of your soul, you're still crude. Your nature is that of a crude man, and this crudeness is revealed in the basis of this strategic plan. It's greedy. Humanity doesn't have the ability to manufacture so many stellar hydrogen bombs. Even if all of Earth's industrial resources were exhausted, it wouldn't produce even one-tenth of that number. And a million stellar hydrogen bombs is far from enough to decelerate Mercury into the sun. With a soldier's recklessness, you formulated this impossible plan and then stubbornly carried it forward step by step with the wily calculations of a superior strategist. Wallfacer Ray Diaz, this is truly a tragedy. As Ray Diaz looked at the wall breaker, his expression gradually filled with an elusive softness, and hints of convulsions showed on his coarsely lined face, gradually taking shape until at last his suppressed laughter erupted. He laughed, pointing at the wall breaker.
Superman! I remember now. That old Superman, he could fly, and he could reverse the rotation of the Earth. But when he was riding a horse, he fell and broke his neck.
It was Christopher Reeve, the actor who played Superman, who fell and broke his neck. The wall breaker corrected him quietly.
Do you imagine that your fate will be better than his?
Since coming here, I have no regard for my fate. I've lived a full life, the wallbreaker said evenly. But you, Mr. Ray Diaz, ought to think about your own fate. You'll die first, Ray Diaz said, smiling with his entire face as he pressed the cigar end directly between the wallbreaker's eyes. Then, when the wallbreaker was covering his face with his hands, Ray Diaz took up a military-issue belt from the sofa, wrapped it around the wallbreaker's neck, and strangled him with every ounce of his strength. Although the wallbreaker was young, he had no way to defend against Ray Diaz's agile strength, and was thrown to the floor by his neck. Ray Diaz bellowed,
"I'll wring your neck, you bastard! Who sent you here to play smart? Who the hell are you, bastard? I'll wring your neck!"
He tightened the belt and slammed the wallbreaker's head into the ground repeatedly to the crunch of teeth smacking into the floor. When the guards burst in to separate them, the wallbreaker's face was purple. He was foaming at the mouth, and his eyes were protruding like a goldfish's. Ray Diaz, still in a fury, struggled with the guards as he continued to shout,
"Wring his neck! String him up and hang him! Right now! This is part of the plan! Do you fucking hear me? Part of the plan!"
But the three guards did not carry out this order. One of them held Ray Diaz tightly, while the other two lifted up the wallbreaker, who had recovered his breath somewhat, and started to carry him out.
"Just you wait, you bastard! You won't die easy," he said, abandoning his efforts to escape the guard and have another go at the wallbreaker.
He let out a long sigh. The wall-breaker looked back over the guard's shoulder, a smile on his bruised and swollen face. He opened up a mouth that was missing several teeth and said, "I've lived a full life." PDC Wallfacer Hearing. As the meeting commenced, the United States, the United Kingdom, France and Germany put up another proposition, this one demanding the immediate suspension of Ray Diaz's position as Wallfacer and his trial before the International Court of Justice for Crimes Against Humanity. The US representative declared, "After a substantial investigation, we believe that Ray Diaz's strategic intent, as disclosed by the Wallbreaker, is credible. What we are facing now is a person whose crime dwarfs all of the crimes ever committed in human history. We were unable to find a single law applicable to his crime, so we recommend that the crime of extinction of life on Earth be added to international law, and that Ray Diaz be tried under it." Ray Diaz appeared quite relaxed at the hearing. Sneering, he said to the US representative, "You've been trying to get rid of me, haven't you? Ever since the Wallfacer Project began, you have all applied a double standard to the Wallfacers. I'm the one you like least." The UK representative retorted, "Wallfacer Ray Diaz's claim is baseless. In fact, the countries he is accusing are the ones who invested the most money into his plan, far exceeding what they invested in the other three Wallfacers." "Sure," Ray Diaz said with a nod. "But the real reason you invested so heavily in my plan is because you wanted to get your hands on the stellar hydrogen bombs." "Ridiculous. What would we do with them?" the US representative shot back. "They're incredibly inefficient weapons in a space battle, and on the Earth, there's no practical significance even for those old 20-megaton hydrogen bombs, much less 300-megaton monster." Ray Diaz responded calmly, "But the bombs will be the most effective weapon in battles on other planets, particularly in wars among humans. On the desolate surface of other planets, there's no need to be concerned with civilian casualties or environmental damage, so you're free to carry out wide-area destruction or even a devastating sweep of the entire surface. Here's where the stellar hydrogen bombs will prove useful. You must have anticipated that as humanity expands into the solar system, Earth's conflicts will expand outward as well. This won't change even with Trisolaris as a common enemy, and you're preparing for it. Right now, it's politically indefensible to develop superweapons for use against humans, so you took advantage of me to make them." The US representative said, "That's the preposterous logic of a terrorist and a dictator. Ray Diaz is the kind of man who granted the status and power of a Wallfacer, turns the Wallfacer Project into as big a danger as the Trisolaran invasion. We must take decisive action to correct this mistake." "They're as good as their word," Ray Diaz said, turning to Garanine, the incumbent rotating chair. "The CIA has men waiting outside to arrest me as soon as I go outside after this hearing." The rotating chair glanced in the direction of the US representative, who was fiddling intently with his pen. Garanine had first taken office at the start of the Wallfacer Project, and even he had forgotten the number of short terms in office he had served during the ensuing 2 decades. But this was the last time. Now, white-haired, he was about to retire.
"Wallfacer Ray Diaz, if what you say is true, then that is inappropriate. So long as the principles of the Wallfacer Project still hold, Wallfacers have legal immunity, and none of their words and actions can be used as evidence to charge them of a crime," he said.
"Additionally, please remember that this is international territory," the Japanese representative said.
"So does that mean," the US representative said, raising a pencil,
that even when Ray Diaz is about to detonate the million superbombs he's buried on Mercury, society still won't be able to charge him with a crime? According to the relevant provisions in the Wallfacer Act, placing limitations and curbs on the strategic plans of wallfacers who exhibit dangerous tendencies is an entirely separate matter from the wallfacer's own legal immunity, Garanin said. Ray Diaz's crimes have crossed outside the boundary of legal immunity. He must be punished. This is a precondition for the continued existence of the Wallfacer Project, the UK representative said. May I remind the chair and the representatives, Ray Diaz said, rising from his seat, that this is a PDC Wallfacer hearing, and that I am not on trial.
You'll stand in court soon, the US representative said, with a chilly smile. I agree with Wallfacer Ray Diaz. We should return to the discussion of his strategic plan, Garanin said, seizing the opportunity to temporarily bypass the thorny issue. The Japanese representative broke his silence.
From the way it looks now, the representatives have reached a consensus on the following point. Ray Diaz's strategic plan exhibits dangerous tendencies toward clear violations of human rights, and according to the relevant principles in the Wallfacer Act, it should be stopped.
Then Proposition P-269 proposed at the previous Wallfacer hearing regarding halting Ray Diaz's strategic plan can now be put to a vote, Garanin said.
Mr. Chair, wait one moment. Ray Diaz raised his hand. Before the vote, I hope I might be able to offer a final explanation of some of the details of my plan.
If they're just details, is this really necessary? Someone asked.
Save it for court, the UK representative said sarcastically.
No, these details are important, Ray Diaz persisted. Right now, let us assume that what the Wallbreaker has disclosed about my strategic intentions is true. One representative spoke of the moment when the million hydrogen bombs deployed on Mercury are ready to be detonated, at which point I will face the omnipresent Sophons and declare to Trisolaris humanity's intent to die with them. What will happen then?
The Trisolaran's reaction can't be predicted, but on Earth it's certain that billions of people will want to wring your neck, just like you did to that Wallbreaker, the French representative said.
Exactly. So I took certain measures to deal with such a situation. Take a look at this.
Ray Diaz raised his left hand and displayed his wristwatch to the assembly. It was entirely black, and the dial was twice as large and thick as a normal men's watch, although it didn't appear large on his thick wrist.
This is a transmitter sending a signal through a space link directly to Mercury.
You'll use it to send the detonation signal? Someone asked.
Precisely the opposite. It sends a non-detonation signal.
His words focused the attention of the entire assembly. He went on,
The system is codenamed Cradle, meaning that when the cradle stops rocking, the baby will wake. It sends a continuous signal, received continuously on Mercury. If the signal is interrupted, then the system will immediately detonate the hydrogen bomb.
It's called a dead man's switch, the US representative said stoically. In the Cold War, there was research into using anti-triggers and dead man switches on strategic nukes, but they were never implemented. Only a madman would actually do it.
Ray Diaz brought down his left hand and covered the cradle with his sleeve. I was taught this wonderful idea not by an expert in nuclear strategy, but by an American film. In it, a man has one of these gadgets that sends out a continuous signal, but if his heart stops beating, the signal is terminated. Another man has a bomb strapped to him that's impossible to remove,
and if the bomb doesn't receive the signal, it'll explode. So even though this hapless fool doesn't like the first guy, he has to do everything he can to protect him. I like watching American blockbusters. Even today, I can still recognize the old version of Superman.
Do you mean that this device is tied to your heartbeat?
The Japanese representative asked. He reached over to Ray Diaz, who was standing next to him, to touch the device under his sleeve, but Ray Diaz moved his arm and stood a bit further away.
Of course, but the cradle is more advanced and refined than that. It monitors not just the heartbeat, but lots of other physiological indicators, such as blood pressure, body temperature, and so forth, and conducts a comprehensive analysis of these parameters. If they're not normal, then it immediately stops the anti-trigger signal in the dead man's switch. It can also recognize many of my simple voice commands.
A nervous-looking man entered the auditorium and whispered something into Garanin's ear. Before he had finished whispering, Garanin glanced up at Ray Diaz with a peculiar look in his eyes, which did not escape the keen-eyed representatives.
There's a way to disarm your cradle. Countermeasures for anti-triggers were studied during the Cold War too, the U.S. representative said. He's not my cradle. He's the cradle for those hydrogen bombs. If the cradle stops rocking, they'll wake up, Ray Diaz said.
I've thought about the same technique, the German representative said. When the signal is transmitted from your watch to Mercury, it must pass through a complicated communications link, destroying or shielding any node, then using a false signal source to continue to transmit the anti-trigger signal farther down the chain, will render your cradle system useless.
That is indeed a problem, Ray Diaz said with a nod at the German representative. Without the Sophons, the problem is easily solved. All the nodes are loaded with an identical encryption algorithm that generates every signal sent. To the outside world, it looks as if the signal values are random and different every time. But the cradle sender and recipient produce a sequence of values that are identical. Only when the recipient received a signal corresponding to its own sequence is the signal considered valid. Without this encryption algorithm, the signal sent out by your false source won't match the recipient's sequence. But the damn Sophons can detect the algorithm.
You've perhaps come up with another approach? Someone asked.
A crude approach. Me, all my approaches are clumsy and crude, Ray Diaz said with a self-mocking laugh. I have increased the sensitivity of each node's monitoring of its own state. Specifically, each communication node is composed of several units that may be separated by a large distance, but are connected into a whole by continuous communication. If any one unit fails, the entire node will issue a command terminating the anti-trigger, after which, even if the false signal source resumes sending a signal to the next node, it will not be acknowledged. The monitoring of every unit can achieve a microsecond level of accuracy, which means that, using the German representative's approach, every unit of a node must be simultaneously destroyed, and the signal resumed from the false signal source within the space of a microsecond. Every node is composed of at least three units, but many have dozens of them. These units are separated by a distance of about 300 kilometers. Each one is built to be extremely rugged, and it will issue its warning upon any outside touch. Causing these units to fail within the space of a microsecond might be possible for the Trisolarans, but is not currently possible for humans.
His final sentence put everyone on alert.
I have just received a report that the thing on Ray Diaz's wrist
has been sending out electromagnetic signal, Garanin said. The atmosphere of the assembly turned tense at the news.
I'd like to ask you, Wolfacer Ray Diaz, is the signal from your wristwatch being sent to Mercury?
Ray Diaz chuckled a few times, then said,
Why would I be sending it to Mercury? There's nothing there but a giant pit. Besides, the Cradle space communication link hasn't been set up yet. No, no, no. You don't need to worry. The signal isn't going to Mercury. It's going somewhere in New York City, very close to us.
The air froze, and everyone in the assembly, apart from Ray Diaz, stood as shocked as wooden chickens.
If the signal sustaining the Cradle is terminated, what will it trigger?
The UK representative asked sharply, no longer attempting to mask his tension.
Oh, something will be triggered, all right, Ray Diaz said to him with a broad laugh. I've been a wallfacer for more than 20 years, and I've always been able to get a few things of my own.
Well then, Mr. Ray Diaz, would you be able to answer an even more direct question?
The French representative said. He looked entirely calm, but there was a tremble in his voice.
How many lives will you or will we be responsible for?
Ray Diaz widened his eyes at the Frenchman, as if he thought the question bizarre.
What? The number of people makes a difference? I thought all of you here were respectable gentlemen who prize human rights above all. What's the difference between one life and 8.2 million? If it's the former, then you don't have to respect it?
The U.S. representative stood up and said,
More than 20 years ago, when the Wallfacer project began, we pointed out what he was, pointing a finger at Ray Diaz and spraying saliva as he spoke.
He strove to contain himself, but ended up losing control.
He's a terrorist, an evil, filthy terrorist, a devil. You unstop the bottle and let him loose, and you must take responsibility. The UN must be held responsible,
he shouted hysterically, sending his papers flying.
Calm down, Mr. Representative, Ray Diaz said with a slight smile. The Cradle is very sensitive to my physiological indices. If I were to go into hysterics like you, if my mood wavered, it would immediately stop sending the anti-trigger signal. So you and all of you sitting here shouldn't make me too upset. It would be better for all of us if you could try and keep me happy.
What are your conditions?
Garanin asked softly. A bit of sadness crept into the smile on Ray Diaz's face as he turned toward Garanin and shook his head.
Mr. Chair, what other conditions could I name? To leave here and return to my own country. A charter plane is waiting for me at Kennedy Airport.
The assembly was silent.
Unconsciously, they had all gradually turned their attention from Ray Diaz to the U.S. representative, who, unable to stand all the eyes on him, threw himself back into his chair and hissed,
Get the hell out!
Ray Diaz slowly nodded, and then stood up and walked out.
Mr. Ray Diaz, I'll take you home, Garanin said, leaving the rostrum.
Ray Diaz stood waiting for Garanin as he walked over less nimbly than before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought you might like to get out of here, too.
The two were at the door when Ray Diaz grabbed Garanin and turned with him back toward the auditorium.
Gentlemen, I won't miss this place. I wasted these 2 decades, and no one here understands me. I want to go back to my homeland, back to my people. Yes, my homeland and my people, I miss them.
To everyone's surprise, the big man's eyes shone with tears. At last he said,
I want to go back to my homeland. This is not part of the plan.
When he walked out the door of the UN General Assembly building,
Ray Diaz opened his arms wide to the sun and called out with relish,
"Ah, my son!"
His two-decade-long heliophobia had vanished. Ray Diaz's flight took off and crossed the eastern coastline to fly over the vast Atlantic Ocean. In the cabin, Garanine said to him,
"With me here, this aircraft is safe. Please tell me the location of the device you have connected to the dead man's switch."
"There is no device. There's nothing. It was just a trick to escape."
Ray Diaz took off his watch and handed it to Garanine.
"This is just a simple transmitter, converted from a Motorola phone. It's not connected to my heartbeat either. It's been turned off. Keep it as a souvenir."
For a long time, neither of them spoke. When Garanine sighed and said,
"How did this happen?" The Wallfacer's privilege of sealed-off strategic thinking was meant to be used against the Sophons and Trisolaris, but you and Tyler both used it against humanity.
"There's nothing strange about that," Ray Diaz said. He sat next to the window, enjoying the sunlight shining in from the outside. "Right now, the greatest obstacle to humanity's survival comes from itself."
6 hours later, the plane touched down at Caracas International Airport on the Caribbean coast. Garanine did not get off. He would be taking the plane back to the UN. When they parted, Ray Diaz said,
"Don't abort the Wallfacer project. It really is a hope amid this war. There are still 2 Wallfacers. Please wish them the best for me."
"I won't be seeing them either," Garanine said with emotion.
By the time Ray Diaz walked off, leaving him alone in the cabin, he was in tears. The sky over Caracas was as clear as in New York. Ray Diaz walked down the air stair and smelled the familiar tropical atmosphere, then bent down and gave a long kiss to the ground of his homeland. Then, guarded by a large detachment of military police, he took a motorcade to the city. After half an hour on a winding mountain road, they entered the capital and drove up to the city centre and Plaza Bolivar. At the statue of Simon Bolivar, Ray Diaz got out of the car and stood on the statue's base. Above him, on horseback, was the great armor-clad hero who had defeated the Spanish and tried to establish a unified republic of Gran Colombia in South America. In front of him, a crowd of frenetic people boiled under the sun, swelling forward, only to be met with the vigorous resistance of the military police. Shots were fired into the air, but the tide of people eventually surged past the police line and poured toward the living Bolivar at the foot of the statue. Ray Diaz held up his hands and, with tears in his eyes, called out to the crowd in a voice dripping with emotion,
"Ah, my people!"
The first stone thrown by his people struck him on his outstretched left hand. The second hit him on the chest, and the third smashed into his forehead and nearly knocked him out. After that, the people's stones came like raindrops and had practically buried his lifeless body by the end. The last stone that hit Wallfacer Ray Diaz was thrown by an old woman who struggled to carry it up to his corpse, then said in Spanish,
"Evil doer, you would kill everyone. My grandson would have been there. You'd have killed my grandson!"
Then, using all the strength in her trembling hands, she slammed her stone against Ray Diaz's broken skull, where it lay exposed beneath the pile of rocks. Time is the one thing that can't be stopped. Like a sharp blade, it silently cuts through hard and soft, constantly advancing. Nothing is capable of jolting it even the slightest bit, but it changes everything. The same year as the Mercury test, Cheng Wei-sir retired. In his final media appearance, he frankly acknowledged that he himself had no confidence in victory, but this did not affect history's high opinion of the work of the Space Force's first commander. Working for so many years in a state of anxiety had damaged his health, and he died at the age of 68. The general was lucid on his deathbed and mentioned Zheng Beihai's name many times. After leaving her second term in office, Secretary-General Say launched the Human Memorial Project, whose goal was the comprehensive collection of data and commemorative artifacts of human civilization that would ultimately be sent out into the cosmos on unmanned spacecraft. The project's most influential component was called the Human Diary, a website that was set up to allow as many people as possible to record their lifetimes in the form of text and images from their everyday lives to become part of the data of civilization. The Human Diary website eventually grew to have more than 2 billion users and formed the largest ever body of information on the internet. Later, the PDC, believing that the Human Memorial Project contributed to defeatism, passed a resolution stopping its further development, and even equated it with escapism. But Say continued to pour her individual efforts into the project until she passed away at the age of 84. After retirement, Garanine and Kent made the same choice, to seclude themselves in that Garden of Eden in northern Europe, where Luo Ji had lived for 5 years. They were never again seen by the outside world, and no one even knew the exact date they died. But one thing was certain, they lived a long time. Some said that the two of them reached the century mark before dying a natural death. Just as Keiko Yamasuki had predicted, Wu Yue spent the remainder of his life in depression and confusion. He worked for more than a decade on the Human Memorial Project, but was unable to find any solace in it, and he passed away in loneliness at the age of 77. Like Cheng Wei-sir, Wu Yue had Zheng Beihai's name on his lips in his final moments. They pinned their shared hopes for the future on the stalwart warrior now hibernating through time. Dr. Albert Rangier and General Fitzroy both lived into their 80s and saw the completion of the 100-metre Hubble 3 space telescope, which they used to look at the planet Trisolaris. But they never again saw the Trisolaran fleet or the probes now flying ahead of it. They did not live long enough for them to cross the third patch of snow. The lives of ordinary people continued and ended as well. Out of the three old Beijing neighbours, Miao Fuchuan was the first to depart, passing away at the age of 75. He really did have his son bury him 200 meters down an abandoned mine, and his son obeyed his last wishes to blow up the mine wall and erect a tombstone to remember him. According to his father's will, the last generation before the Doomsday Battle was supposed to clear out the tombstone, and if humanity won, then it could be restored to its original location. But in fact, less than half a century after his death, the area over the mineshaft became a desert. The tombstone disappeared, the mine's location was lost, and the Miao family's descendants couldn't be bothered to look for it. Zheng Yuan Chao died of illness like an ordinary person at the age of 80, and like an ordinary person, he was cremated. His ashes were laid in an ordinary rectangular slot on a long rack in a public cemetery. Yang Jin Wen lived till 92, and the alloy vessel containing his remains headed out of the solar system and into the vast cosmos at the third cosmic velocity. This consumed all of his savings. But Ding Yi lived on. After the breakthrough in controlled fusion technology, he turned his attention to theoretical physics, looking for ways to escape Sophon interference in high-energy particle physics experiments. He had no success. When he reached his 70s, he had, like other physicists, abandoned all hope of the possibility of a breakthrough. He entered hibernation and planned to wake at the Doomsday Battle. His sole desire was to be able to see with his own eyes the superior technology of Trisolaris. In the century following the start of the Trisolar Crisis, everyone who had lived through the Golden Age passed away. It was an era that was constantly recalled, and the old folks who had lived through those grand times chewed over their memories of it like ruminants, savouring the flavours. They always closed with one line, "Ah, if only we knew how to cherish things back then." Young people would listen to their stories with a mixture of envy and scepticism. That fabled peace, prosperity, and happiness, that ideal utopia free from care, did it ever really exist? As the elderly passed away, the departed Golden Shore vanished into the smoke of history. The ship of human civilization floated alone in the vast ocean, surrounded on all sides by endless sinister waves, and no one knew if there even was an opposite shore.